Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Matthew Miller, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Kira Sirota about her new book, Haftorah Unrolled, published in 2018. Haftorah Unrolled by Kira Sirota offers a deep and accessible exploration of the Haftorah, the series of selections from the prophets traditionally read in synagogues. Blending deep insight with clear, engaging translations, Sirota illuminates these ancient texts, revealing their timeless wisdom and relevance to modern life. Kira, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
I'm from the former Soviet Union, and I usually, when I talk about my book, I usually mention a story that is the dedication of the book. My parents grew up in Stalin Russia, which means that everything Jewish was effectively illegal. So they grew up without any access to any Jewish text. They didn't have a Tanakh. They didn't celebrate the holidays. And when I was growing up in the 1970s, I wasn't even aware that there's such a thing as Hanukkah or Pesach or anything else, really. I didn't know that Jews don't eat pork. Like, that information never crossed our horizons. And it's not because I was not an observant child in the sense of seeing the world around me. That was not the problem. It's because we had whatever we were able to eat, we ate. It was a time of famine in the Soviet Union. In any case, in 1979, we were able to get out, and the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society that took care of us along the journey made sure that on our first stop in the free world, which was in Vienna, they made sure that we had food to eat, a stipend, a place to stay, and they also handed us a Bible in Russian. Now, we had never seen a Bible. My parents had never seen a Bible. They were in the 40s at the time. And my mother had this habit that when she would get a new book, she'd open it in the middle. And then she'd look around and she'd read a little bit. And if she liked what she read, then she'd go back to the beginning. She wasn't worried about spoilers. So this is what she did. So she took this book. I remember it very well, with the green cover. And she opened it up, and her eye caught on a verse, a pasuk, that went as follows. I will say to the north, give over, and to the south, do not restrain. Bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the ends of the earth. And she looked at it and she said, wow, I will say to the north, give over. So that happened, right? So indeed, the north had let us go. And the remainder of this verse was also fulfilled years later, and my sister, as well as myself, as well as my parents, ultimately made Aliyah, and my parents got to spend their retirement years in Israel watching their 11 grandchildren speak Hebrew and learn Torah and celebrate all the holidays and enjoy their tradition. And from this I learned as a child that the Tanakh, it speaks to us, right? It's not talking to somebody else. It's talking to us and has real things to say. And that actually informed all my work and all my teaching since then. So just to sum up after that, so I was 10 years old when I got to America. I didn't really know English. I was able to count to 10. I think that was the extent of my knowledge. And I didn't know any Hebrew. I had learned a little bit of the alphabet. A funny story that when we knew that we were about to leave, we thought we'd be going to Israel. So my mother found a dictionary that had the alphabet in it. And she said, hey, let's sit down. Let's try to learn to read Hebrew. Okay. And we opened up what it said there. And it said, Aleph is not pronounced. So we looked at each other. And we said, okay. So that ended that. I came in not even knowing the alphabet, really. Fortunately, my parents were very brave, and they sent me and my sister to a Jewish day school, which is a brave thing to do when you come from the Soviet Union, because there the attitude was, and this is how they were raised for this is their entire lives, that people who are intelligent, intelligenti, which is used the same way in Hebrew and in Russian, they're not religious, and religious people are not intelligenti. Yeah. It's quite a block to be able to say, no, this is in fact our tradition. But that's what my mother said. They stole our tradition from us, and we're going to get it back. So my sister and I went to Jewish schools. I went to Hafter. We ended up living in Farakwe and then in Cedarhurst, New York, and went to schools. And by we caught up. I went to Mechlela for after high school. And then I went to Harvard for university. I studied linguistics and computer science, and I'm a programmer by profession, a software developer, and that's what I've been doing for the past very many years. And this is my avocation that is also, that is not my vocation. It is my hobby and the great joy. So even at Harvard, I studied linguistics, but I had the opportunity, a truly lucky opportunity. I'm glad I had the foresight to take advantage of it. I took a class with Rav Professor Yitzchak Torsky, Professor Isidore Torsky, may his memory be a blessing, Zichrono Livracha. It was just a graduate seminar, and it was just a handful of us around the table, and it was whatever he wanted to teach. I think it took me maybe 10 years later. I woke up one morning, I said, oh, I understand now what the class was. Like, literally, that's how it was. But it was truly an honor, and I learned from him. What we would do is he'd be reading the introduction of Rav Chesdai Kreskes to some work of his. And he would go around and he would read something in Hebrew and he'd make us translate. And it would be one of those, I'm thinking of a word. You guys have to, what word am I thinking of? And we had to get it exactly right. Not like a little bit, but exactly. So if there's any level of precision in my translation, that is due to his demand, his influence. Anyway, but then, like I said, I got married. We lived in the States for a little while. And then we made Aliyah with, at the time, 5 kids. I have 2 sets of twins. So they're all the same age. And we had 2 more here in Israel. And here I've been working, like I said, as a software developer. And also, I've been taking at least 1 class in Matan Sharon, for all these years. So it adds up after a while. And with this book, what happened was, there was 1 year that, I don't know, I just felt like at a loss. I felt like I wasn't doing enough. And my husband said, hey, why don't you teach? And I said, that's a good idea. In order to teach, I have to prepare. And if I'm going to teach something, I want it to be the Haftorahs. Why the Haftorahs? Because I remember it was like catching up, right? Not knowing what's going on. And the truth is, I understood that I wasn't the only one who doesn't know what's going on when it comes to the Haftorahs. Right? Even women come to shul usually by the time of Haftorah reading, but not only. The men, you hear of, people have been telling me, oh, Haftorah, that's when I go for the Kiddush Club, right? People feel very lost and feel very disoriented, and it's unpleasant. And I know how unpleasant that is because that's how I grew up, catching up. So I don't like knowing something. So then I said, the only way to really understand something is to teach it. That was before I wrote a book, because the only way to really know something is to write about it. Because when you teach, you can wave your hands. You could say, I'm doing now, I'm waving my hands, let me explain. When you're writing, you can't do that. Every word counts. And you can't just say things because they're cool. You have to have this one thing that you're saying. In any case, so I spent a year preparing, in part with Rabbi Beryl Wein's tapes. Rabbi Wein, who wrote the foreword for this book, is really close with our family. My husband grew up in Muncie, went to his school. And when I started writing this book as a book, I sent him some early chapters and he wrote me back. I have a handwritten note from him saying, this is valuable. You have to keep doing this. Put in the effort and get it done. And so I'm a little bit jumping ahead in the story. What happened was I prepared for a year. And then I started teaching, and the class was in my parents' home here in Onana. Like, it was announced during shul, in the synagogue, Tuesday night class at the Rosenberg residence with Kira Sirota on the topic of Torah. And there was a handful of people that would come every single week, rain or shine, mostly older folks, and they came as couples, because it wasn't like a class for women or a class. It was a class for couples, and it was like the couples activity. And they came every single week. And what I decided to do is I needed to be in English, because my parents never really, they caught up with the English, sort of, but they never caught up with the Hebrew. So I had to be in English, and I had to be translated. And what I wanted to do was to translate it according, I wanted to be like the linear Rashi. The old linear Rashi that is phrase by phrase, and it's so useful and everybody loves it so much. So I want to be like that for 2 reasons. Reason number 1, it makes it a lot easier to read. But the more important reason is the most of the prophecy, the Nevuah and Haftarah, it's poetry. It's not prose. So if it's if it is formatted as poetry, phrase by phrase, then people will relate to it as poetry. So I said, okay, what I want to do is phrase by phrase translation broken up according to the cantillation marks, Tamei Mikra, which is in fact the punctuation of the Tanakh. And I looked around and there wasn't an existing translation like that. So I made one myself. And if I'm already making a translation myself, then I'm going to get rid of all the beholds and the these and the thous and so on. And so I went ahead and did that. And I formatted it in like Word as a word table, right side Hebrew, left side English. Carriage returns it every time there's a cantillation mark of the appropriate form. And then went phrase by phrase and translated. And then I taught the class, very homely style. This is not an academic work, nor do I ever pretend that it is an academic work. It is a labor of love, and it's my understanding of the Haftarah. I used the more popular commentaries, a lot of Mitsuda. Malbim was very helpful, Abarbanel occasionally. Rav Arya Kaplan has a translation of the Living Torah. I relied on that as well. But also made an effort the entire time I was working on this and the entire time that the book was being published, I didn't read any other books in the Haftarah so that I wouldn't inadvertently use somebody else's ideas and not realize. I did do research myself, although not directly like that. I used the Har Etzion, the Herzog website a lot. I have connections to there as well. All five of my sons studied in Yeshivat Har Etzion. And anyway, so that's one thing. But the really cool part is what is the connection between the Haftarah and the Parsha. So in any case, what happened was the class went on for a year and a half, so we ended up doing an entire cycle. And as I said, people kept showing up week after week, and I had to keep producing the material week after week, which was a lot of stress, but I got it done. And also the connection. So with the connection, I looked at Midrashim. The Medrash, the way it works is, in general, the way Medrash works, is there's an idea that Chazal want to present, the sages want to present, and they'll say the idea, and then they'll bring several verses as proof text. And a lot of times when people learn Medrash, they ignore the proof text. They get the idea, very nice, say it. They don't bother with the proof text. But you know what? It turns out that the right way to actually learn Medrash is not only look at the proof text, you have to actually open it and look at it in context. That's in general. In this particular case, there were definitely Midrashim that would quote as their sources a pasuk in the Parsha, another pasuk in the Haftarah. And if you think about it, the choice of Haftarah for the Parsha is actually the earliest Parshanut, the earliest commentary that we have on the Parsha, on the Torah itself. Because it goes way, way back. It's mentioned in the Mishnah. It probably predates the Mishnah. It's possible it goes far back as Anshei Knesset HaGdola. There are all kinds of legends and stories about how it started, but there's the story that they weren't allowed to use to read from the Torah, were allowed to use from the prophets. I'm not entirely convinced that's what happened, but regardless, it is the halacha. Our custom and law is very clear. You have to read the Parsha, you have to read the Haftarah. In fact, there are special Shabbos throughout the year that have a name, they're named after the Haftarah. This is not the sort of thing you're supposed to neglect and go to the Kiddush Club for. For instance, Shabbat HaGadol. Why is it called Shabbat HaGadol? Because of the Haftarah. Yeah? Called Shabbat Shuva. Because of Haftarah. It's important. It's the halacha. And also, whereas there are few variations between Sfardim and Ashkenazim, the Rambam lists a set of the Haftarahs in the Mishneh Torah. This is not a joke. So there are a few variations, but not really as many as you would think. My book just follows whatever our particular sitter and Chumash says. It does not have the full set of the Sfardi, Temani, and Chabad. It's our minhag because I had to limit myself to what we do. But yeah, so it's actually, so what did I do? I looked for these midrashim. A lot of times I found them. And if there's a midrash that connects the Parsha and the Haftarah, then the area in which it connects gives us insight that we otherwise wouldn't see. That you take the Parsha, you take the Haftarah, you put them together, and you see a facet, the facets of the Torah line up. We say they're Torah 70 facets. So you got to line them up and then you get a different kaleidoscope than you otherwise would. So that's one method I used. The other method that I used was effectively what Chazal did to themselves. And this is also the methodology that is used by the Beit Midrash of Herzog of Har Tzion, started with, I think, Nechama Leibowitz herself, with my teachers that I've learned from, such as Rav Yoel Binun and Rav Yaakov Meid. What do? You look at words that are used in one, and you look at words that are used in the other, especially if those phrases are not used anywhere else. So a really very blatant example of this is in Vayera, where there's an entire chunk of text that is the same in the Parsha and in the Torah. So even though there's no medrash on that specifically, still there's like a chunk of text. And then we look at one, you look at the other, and you say, okay, what do we learn from Elisha telling the Isha Shunamit, the lady from Shunam, at the season, at the time of births, versus the angels telling Abraham and Sarah at the season and the time of births? What do we learn about Sarah? What do we learn about the Shunamit? What do we learn about the concept of opening your home to people? What do we learn about children and the need and desire and the importance and the miracle of children? So you put the two together, you ask different questions that are normally asked, and you wind up with different answers. So I ended up doing that week after week. Often I found more than one Vayera. I had four or five different connections. That's my favorite, actually. And it was a class, it was an hour and a half. And I did that for a year and a half. We did a full cycle and a half. And then my youngest son was born. And so we had to stop doing it. And then people would say, hey, that was some very valuable stuff. You should really write it up. And I said, okay, that's a nice idea. And every so often I'd try, like I said, at a full-time job and seven children. But every so often I'd sit down and try to write. So I wrote Vayera first. And I wrote all the thoughts that I had in Vayera, because there are a lot of them. There are a lot of connections and all kinds of interesting things. And it was like 30 pages. And I sent that to Rabbi Wein. Rabbi Wein said, this is awesome. You should make a book. I said, that's very nice. But it was very hard and it wasn't really happening. And other people I sent it to weren't as enthusiastic. So I wrote up by and by over many years. I wrote up most of Reshit, and it wasn't really going anywhere. And then a friend of mine said, listen, if it's going to be a Parsha book, Parsha books are a certain size, like enough time to read something before you fall asleep. We all know the size, right? There's that famous joke about the Abarbanel that it turned a lot of people into Apikorsim, into heretics, because he asked all the questions in the front. You read the questions, you fall asleep before you get to the answers. So a Parsha book has to be a certain size. So I said, okay, you know what? I'll start cutting it up. Maybe that'll work. Maybe this will work. And then the father passed away, meanwhile. And a few months after that, a friend of mine was visiting, and she said, listen, what you have, the translations that you have, just themselves are really valuable. She knows because she'd asked me to use them for her classes when she teaches. Oh, this parag that I'm teaching, this chapter, is a haftorah. Can I use your translation? I'm like, sure, you could use my translation with pleasure. She said, take just the translations because they're good and they're valuable and people like them. Just put that online. Just do that. And I said, really? I said, yeah, just do that. So I said, oh, you know what? Maybe. So this is Sukkos. And I said, okay, you know what? Never mind Reshit because it's Sukkos and we're busy and there's Chag. But maybe in time for Noach, I'll do it. So I sat down and I took the translation. I said, you know what? I can't just put out the translation because there's nobody to explain it. And even if the translation is very clear, you still often don't know what's going on, right? Like you can't always tell, is it good news? Is it bad news? Is this a new topic or the same topic? Is it the Jewish people talking to God? Is it God talking to the Jewish people? Is it the prophet talking to somebody else? A lot of times you can't tell. A lot of times the commentaries can't tell. And I'm not there as a teacher to wave my hands and explain what's going on. So what I felt the need to do was to actually split it up into chunks. And before every chunk, explain what you're about to read. So when you actually read it, it makes sense to you. And you say, yes, okay, what Kira told me, that's actually what I'm seeing. And now I understand. And you feel more relaxed and more anchored and can enjoy the words of poetry that you're reading because you don't feel lost. And there's another reason that people often feel lost with Haftorah. It's an even more important reason. Unlike the Chumash, the Parsha that we read week after week, which goes in order, yeah, it's Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef, yes? The Haftorah jumps all the heck over the place, right? And it covers over 800 years of Jewish history because the very first parak, the very first chapter of Prophets, which is Yoshua, Parak Aleph, the first chapter of Yoshua, is the Haftorah of Zot HaBracha. The very last chapter in all the prophets is the Haftorah of Shabbat and everything in between. And you never know, week to week, where you're going to find yourself. This past week was B'Shalach. We were in Shoftim. And by the way, what's been going on politically? Who is Dvorah? Who is Barak? Are things good? Are things bad? Are things middle? This week, Yitro is in Yeshayahu. Mishpatim is 150 years later in Yirmiyahu, right? Next, and I think Truma is already back in Shlomo HaMelech, right? Or let's say Machar Chodesh, right? Vayomer David liyonatan Machar Chodesh. Tomorrow is Rosh Chodesh. Okay, great. What was yesterday? Where are we? What's happening? Who are these people? So it's extremely disorienting. And unless you happen to be an expert in Tanakh, which most people are not, unless you happen to be an expert in Tanakh, you feel very lost. So one of the other things I do is before I even have the text of the Haftorah, I intrude briefly as possible. What's been going on? Where are you in Jewish history? What are the challenges of that generation? Who the relevant characters are? And sometimes I even have to have a postscript. Because after, especially let's say with David and Yonatan, like what happened to them afterwards? It ends in a cliffhanger. And also, this is also true, not only true for Nevi'im Rishonim, the early prophets that are more story-based, but also when it comes to a prophecy. A lot of times, it doesn't even start the beginning of a prophecy. It doesn't start with, so said Hashem, A, B, C, D. No, it goes straight to C. You don't even know where, you just really can be very lost. So there's a little bit of a historical introduction. We have the linear phrase-by-phrase translation that is modern. And did the best they could. A lot of times, by the way, a lot of times there are plays on words, right? That it's not just the commentary can't tell what the word should be and they argue about it. It's intentional. Like I'm just thinking Vayasham Shomron, which can be translated from Hashem, guilty, or Shmama, destroyed. Which of them? Both. But I had to pick one. So the translation's mine. Every so often, like I open the book myself and I read it as, oh, I can think of a better word. I can think of a better phrase. You have to finish somewhere. In any case, so I put that up in that format as a post, and it can still be found. It can still be found if you Google. Actually, the truth is, Google will probably find it either way, either Haftorah Unrolled or Haftarah Unrolled with an A, because Haftorah is the more Hamish, the more popular way of saying it. The correct term is Haftarah. And it has still has the original unedited and formatted using Word version of the book. It has a few other things also, some Divrei Torah I've written since, with some things that I've said for my father's yard site. Anyway, you feel free to go look. Anyway, so I did that. I started doing that, and that was also very stressful every week to because there was still a lot of work, taking my translations and then splitting them up into sections, figuring out how to best explain it, figuring out how to write the introduction. As I said, when you're teaching, you could wave your hands around and people understand you. You can see that they understand you. When you're writing, you have to be precise. And so I said, okay, I'll do that. And also, I would take some of the stuff I had already written for Breishit, I'd cut it up into a post-size chunks. Now, everybody knows what a blog post size is, right? It's yay big and has one thought. It's not 30 pages. So I said, okay, so I'm going to do one of those. So I did. I took something I'd written for Noach, and I turned into one of those, and that was the write-up of the connection between the Haftorah and the Parsha, essay, blog post sized. So I did that for a while. And then it turned out that people actually liked it. I sent it out as an email to various friends of the family. I did it in memory of my father, who had, like I said, had passed away earlier that year. And we also printed it out to give out in shul, in the synagogue they would attend. And I did that every week. And I used my kids as like proofreaders in the sense of, hey, does this make sense? And sometimes I'd get a little bit creative in my translation. And sometimes they had to say, hey, mom, that's a little bit too creative. Tone it back a little bit. And the same thing with the essay. So Thursday, I would publish this every Thursday night. And I had a son who was studying at the time, and I'd pick him up at 12 o'clock from the bus stop. And I'd say, okay, Shire, I need you to read the connection to the Parsha essay that I've written. The only thing, I have no idea what I'm going to write yet. Okay, so somehow in the afternoon, by around 5 or 6 o'clock, I would have something, I'd print it out and give it to him. And then he'd look at it and say, I don't understand what you just wrote. I said, but look, isn't it clear? It's this and this. And he said, yeah, you never actually said that. I said, oh, okay, go back. I'd rewrite it, give it to him. He'd say, okay, now that makes sense. And then I'd send it out. So I did that for a year and a half. My kids are very patient and helpful. And then I know school. And the truth is, meanwhile, whenever we'd be in touch with Rabbi Wein, would be, hey, Kira, where's the book? I'm like, listen, so how about a publisher? Like, at this point, I already had something to talk about. I had a year. If you do that for a year and a half, the cycles vary. There's a leap year. It's different from a non-leap year. So I'd done, I think it was a leap year and then a non-leap year at that point. And I was able to recycle after that. And Rabbi Aaron actually sent me to talk to a few publishers. I tried floating it. And they said, listen, publishing at this time, with the economy and everything and the state of publishing, you're going to reach more people with a blog. It's like, all right, maybe. So I let it go. But then sometime later, my husband got a call. And my husband had written something called The Halachas of Superheroes. If you Google it, you'll find it. It's very cute. It's not the size of a book. It's very cute stuff. And a publisher reached out to him. He said, listen, this would make a great book. And how about publishing it? And my husband said, okay, no, that was fun to do, but I'm not really in a position to be making an entire book right now to commit to something like that. But my wife wrote a book. And the guy said, oh, that's nice. And my husband said, Rabbi Wein could write the foreword. And he said, what? So sure enough, Rabbi Wein, actually, he wrote the foreword in 3 days. And then also when we were asked for Haskama, a letter of approbation, he did that the next day on stationery and everything. So you could see it's got like a real-life letter of approbation. And it took me 3 more years to actually get it published because that's when things got really hard. I took what I had, which at the time I thought it was pretty much all of it because I'd done through a cycle and a half. I took what I had. And I sent it over to the publisher. Now, the publisher provided the following services. Provided an editor and a proofreader and a typesetter and the printer. The editor, that was the hardest part, because he sent it to somebody who had actually been involved in some translation projects for ArtScroll, and somebody who knew what he was looking at. And this person took like this giant Word document that I sent, and he read all my translations. And then he marked it up and he said, the commentators say this, why do you say that? And I got this giant Word file back, marked up. It was so big that just saving it took half a minute. And I looked at it and it was all red, all corrections. So I crawled into my bed, put the covers over my head and didn't want to look at it ever again. That's the reaction. But then I got over myself and I found a way. I split it up into little pieces. And in fact, I went over all his comments, sometimes in the haftorahs as well, in the essays as well. He said, okay, what you just said just contradicts what you just said earlier. This doesn't actually make sense. It must have slipped through my son somehow. I don't know how. The first one. Second of all, he actually says, he went over every single word I translated. So that was a lot of work. And some of the time, he said, why'd you do this? And at that point, it had been 10 years since I first translated. And I was like, I don't know. I felt like it that day. And in retrospect, maybe that was not exactly the right choice of words. I'll pick a different one. And in some cases, I said, you know what? This is how I see it. This is how I read it. This is right. And I don't know why the Ibn Ezra doesn't say what I said, because he definitely should, but he doesn't. but it's still the right, that is the pshat, that is the correct thing, and I'm keeping it because it's mine. So I went over everything. And then also there were a lot of haftorahs that I didn't get to for various reasons. Some of them because they weren't actually read. The haftorah, actually, haftsav itself is barely ever read because it's usually Shabbat HaGadol. Acharei Mot is almost never read because Kedoshim is read, right? That one is read. But Acharei Mot is very rarely read, and some shuls never read it. They always read the second one, depending how you hold by the Rama or what. And there are also, to tell you the truth, Breishit I didn't get to, because Breishit is frankly right after Sukkot holidays, and you know what? I'm busy making the holiday. I have to cook, I have to host. I'm a person, right? So I had to fill those in. Miketz was one of the last ones I did. And also, to tell you the truth, it's actually really hard to do them out of season. When it's the Parsha, and that's the week of the Parsha, it's easier to connect to what is actually happening, and it's easier to work on it. To work on Miketz, which is a winter Parsha, in the middle of the summer, is actually a little bit disorienting. So that was actually one of the challenges. So that took 3 years. But then it got done, and there's a book, there's a physical book, and you know what? A physical book is very different from a blog post. It just is. People perceive it differently, you treat it differently, it's just different. And it's something that I am able to leave for my children and for my grandchildren. And it's actually quite well received. I have very different audiences really like it. There's somebody who is, it's a particularly popular with older folk actually, people who have been going to shul their whole lives and are finally like, wow, now I understand what's going on. They really like that. There's an uncle of ours had a chavruta with him and his wife, and they're very close friends. They did a chabura, which was a learning group, the four of them, this whole past year, just on this book. And these are people who are quite learned, who've been around, and they really enjoyed it. And also there's a family I know where the teenagers, not even teenagers, they're preteens before bar mitzvah, the family would require them each to say a Dvar Torah, and they'd pull out my book for their Dvar Torah to say at the Shabbos table. So there's, and also not necessarily people who are, I don't want to say religious, and I don't want to say Orthodox, because we're like really so past that right now, but people who have a limited background. Because I don't make any assumptions about what you may or may not know, because that's the whole point. Everybody pretty much starts out in the same place when it comes to haftorah. Nobody knows anything. So it doesn't assume anything, and people really like it. So that's the story. Long story.
That's great. That's beautiful. And you answered so many of my questions, which I really appreciate. Thank you very much for that.
It's a giant monologue. I don't know if a podcast is supposed to be a giant monologue or not.
It could be whatever we make, and I think that was great. There are some other questions I want to get to as well. One of the other things I wanted to know about is a story that you mentioned before you click record, and you said you might want to share it on air. I wanted to know, please do.
Okay. My publisher wanted this to be as widely accessible as possible to all the Jewish markets, including the very, very religious, I don't know how to say this word politely, the very sheltered, let's call it that, including the very sheltered markets, because you don't want to limit yourself. I have no intention of, you know, as it is, it's niche. Right? Jews are the only ones buying physical books anyway. But to limit the market was not my intention. So he wanted it to be appropriate. Okay? Now, there's a word that recurs rather often in the Haftorahs, to no fault of my own, because I didn't pick them. I didn't write them. I'm just translating. And the word is zona, which I translated as prostitute. So for instance, right? Speaking of Yeshua, Rachav is described as a zona, which is a prostitute, or more interestingly, in Miketz, which is never read. That's not true. I think it was read this year. Very rarely read. The very famous story of the judgment of Solomon, when he, with a baby and everything, cutting the baby in half. Very famous story. So most people don't actually pay attention to the fact that it starts as, then came two prostitutes to the king. They weren't just random ladies, they were prostitutes. Okay, so I translated it as the two prostitutes came to see the king. And then it wasn't the editor, it was actually the proofreader. The proofreader was charged also in addition to checking spelling errors and typos and inelegant grammar and things like that, was also asked to check the appropriateness. So this is when the book is effectively done, right? This is already the proofreader. And she really questioned the use of the word prostitute. And the alternate that they suggested was harlot. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm not calling Rachav a harlot. Because to my ear and my understanding of the connotations of that word, it's a value judgment. It's not a nice thing to call somebody. I'm not going to call Rachav a harlot. And they said, what do you mean? It's just a polite way of saying it. Prostitute is very crass and harlot is more refined. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. That is not my understanding. So I actually took a little bit of a survey among my acquaintances because I couldn't understand like why there's this discrepancy. And it seems that, and indeed, there were many people who said that harlot is the polite way of saying this word, where others were horrified, same as myself. It seems to be, again, not a scientific study, but it seems to be that people who only know that word from translations of the Tanakh, where it appears rather often, they believe that that's just how you say it in a polite, elegant, appropriate way. And people who know what the word harlot has turned into in more recent literature will also felt differently about it. I tried to insist on this, and they were insistent back, saying that this is going to really hurt the chances of the publisher accepting it, the distributor rather accepting it. So I was like, you know what? Fine. But the time I used a different word, Hoshea, when he uses that word, he doesn't mean harlot, he doesn't mean prostitute, he means whore. So I wrote whore. So I rolled the whore back to a harlot, so I felt better. And Rachav, in order, because again, I have to stand on my principles, I did not call her Zonah, a harlot. So actually in the Torah, she's never actually called Zonah herself. In the Torah, it's like more, it goes a little bit sideways there. And in the Medrash, the other verse that I brought as a proof text for something else, where it does call her Rachav Zonah, this is the Torah of Shlach, then there I just left it untranslated. Because that was the other thing that people suggesting, oh, just don't translate. It's like, that's really lame. What do you know? Although I didn't translate the word Tzaraat, I left untranslated because it's not actually leprosy, but I have a footnote explaining how the Rambam says that it's not actually a medical condition because he, the doctor, is not familiar with any medical condition that has those symptoms. So I left it untranslated because I can trust the Rambam, but with a footnote. Anyway, that's my funny story. There's another story with a camel in heat, but they asked me to tone down the camel in heat. I said, I'm sorry, that's really not me. That's Yirmiyahu. There's nothing I can do.
I like that. Those are two great stories. Really helps understand the process of translation and some of the arguments that can happen based on words. I think that's really fascinating. I wanted to make sure that we get a little bit of time just to get a taste of the book and its content and maybe give us an insight or two into some insights that are related to the coming parshiyot, the coming Torah portions that the Jewish communities will be reading over the next week or two. We're recording now. The next parsha is Yitro, but we can do it over the next couple weeks or so.
Let's pretend it's Zachor already. And we'll get there. Eventually we'll get to Zachor. You'll see. The cool thing about Shabbat Zachor is I call that one the reboot. Because the phrases that are used in the Haftorah are also used in the Megillah. And so, for instance, Haman is referred to as Haman ben Hamdata HaGagi. And the king of Amalek that Shaul does not actually kill, that Shmuel has to kill, his name is Agag. So that's a reference. Everybody, you know, it's a relatively famous reference. But Haman is not the only one of the protagonists of the Megillah to be found in the Torah, right? Because Echai is introduced when he comes into the scene. So the role of Shaul is being played by Mordechai. And the heroine of the Megillah, Esther, when Vashti is deposed, it says, Malchutai tena melech liruta tova mimena. The king will give her kingdom to a fellow woman who is better than she. Which is almost a quote from the Haftorah, where Shmuel tears Shaul's garment, and he says, Hashem tore the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your fellow man who is better than you. And Amalek, we all know who's playing that, Asher Karcha Bader, who happened upon you on the land. And the Medrash points out that when Mordechai tells Esther through Hatach, "Vayeged lo Mordechai et kol asher karahu," everything that happened to him. And the Medrash says, "Ah, tell her the grandson of Karahu is here now, that happened upon you on the road." Okay, so we have that, and then if you look at it that way, then you have to ask yourself, okay, what does this actually mean? It's not enough to just wave your hands and say, "Oh, look, cool thing over here, cool thing over there." There's a therefore. It's the Tanakh. It's talking to us, so we have to understand what it's saying to us. So Shaul had the opportunity to do something that will have an impact for eternity, and he saw it as his own battle, his own war, and he did not have the leadership ability to override what the people wanted and to do the right thing. And then Esther, we see, is actually very hesitant to step up, hesitant to risk her life. Really, we all know it was risking her life. Until Mordechai says to her, if you don't do this, at vet avich yovedu, you and your father's house will be destroyed. What does it mean, you and your father's house will be destroyed? Who's her father's house? She's a descendant. Her and Mordechai are presumably, or at least according to the way the text presents them, is a descendant of Shaul. And they get a chance to do it over again, a chance to fix things. And she gets up and she does this. She takes up the challenge, and the use of power is actually a really complicated thing. But I think we feel this now a little bit as a Jewish people. We're very used to being powerless. We know what it's like to be powerless. We know how to handle that. We have much less experience having power. And the same thing was true with Shaul. For Shaul was the first king of Israel. Until then, they were under the rule of the Plishtim, who went as far as making sure that they don't even have blacksmiths, so they can't manufacture weapons. They couldn't protect themselves at all. So going from zero power to exercising power is not a trivial thing. And he made a mistake. He failed. And his failure caused him his dynasty, because if he's not able to do it, then neither will his son, neither will anyone else. And it took until Esther and Mordechai to find a way to use power. It's not the same kind of power, yeah. The Megillah has a happy end, Afocha and all that, but if you think about it, it's not actually a happy ending, because in the end, she's still there. She's still married to Ahasuerus, of course. But even beyond that, the Jewish people are still in exile, and the only kind of power they're able to wield is the power of the viceroy. Yeah, the robes that Mordechai wears are not his, they're the king's. And that's not true power either. But still, in that one aspect, they got to do a reboot, they got to do a do-over, and they got it right. So that's one insight from Zohar.
I appreciate that. That's very powerful and something that we need to be thinking about, both when we read that Torah portion at this current juncture, and always something that we need to think about. I want to make sure that we've had a lot of great conversation and discussion already. Is there anything else that I missed, that you missed, you want to add before we wrap up the conversation?
I don't think so. I think I talked a lot.
I think you said all the right things and the right amount. Don't worry about that at all. As we conclude, I want to ask you the closing question we always ask on New Books Network. What are you working on next?
That's a terrible question to ask an author, right? You realize it's like actually, yeah. When it first came out, that was the first question people asked me. I was like, this is like asking somebody, you know what it's like? Sometimes a woman has a baby, and at the bris, the mohel tells her, "See you next year." It's like that, first of all. But to actually answer, there are two, first of all, I'm not really working on anything right now, but I'm thinking about it. There are two things I'm thinking about. One is an expanded version of this book, because like I said, I did all the parshiot, including the ones that aren't read, like Mitzketz and Acharemo. I didn't do the holidays. I did, let's say, the special Shabbatot, like Zachor. I did Rosh Hashanah Hanukkah, both weeks of Hanukkah. But I didn't do fast days or Tisha B'Av or the holidays. On my website, there are a few. On my website, I have Yom Kippur, and I have, because my son's bar mitzvah was in Shavuot Pesach, so I did that. and I have something on Rosh Hashanah that I presented recently. So that's one thing that I could do. But if I were to do it, I have to also do the ones that are read abroad, which is extra hard because we don't even read them here at all. People say, oh, what do you think about the last day of the Haftarah Shmini Atzeret? I'm like, what Haftarah Shmini Atzeret? Because we read Zohar Bracha, we don't. So there's a lot more work. I don't know if I'll do it, but maybe I will. I don't know. It's a little bit daunting. Now that I know it goes into it, it's a little bit daunting. When I first started, it was like, I had no clue. And it's the kind of thing that you don't realize how much work it's going to be till you do it, till you're there. I just really had siyata deshmaya, like help from above to allow me to do this. Again, full-time job, 7 kids, etc. Now the kids are all grown up, so I don't have that excuse anymore. Now we have the grandchildren. Anyway, the other idea I had, which is cool, and one day I'll get to it, I want to write a book of the history, not really a history, a representation of responsa literature. And I would call it the heartbeat of Torah. And it would go through the generations and talk about the Jewish people and what they were encountering at that time, each community, what their challenges were, and then find a response, which is question and answer, questions from people at the time, answered by some of the greats of our nation, all-time greats, that made the effort, took the time, wrote it, had it, I guess published is the wrong word, we're talking about way before publishing, but Dessen made sure that it got out there, and how they dealt with the things, like the questions that they had and the issues that they had. I think that would be really cool. I'd probably need a partner in that because I'm somewhat familiar with it. It's something I have studied, but certainly not level to be able to pick the best. If you're going to pick one from every generation, how are you going to pick? I'd want it to be like a variety of things, and some things would be heavy. There's a famous book called Responsa from the Holocaust, very highly recommended by Ephraim Oshri. You're familiar with it? Do you know what I mean? To whoever's not familiar, a question is, do I say the blessing of Shelo Asani Aved, who has not made me a slave, if I am in fact currently a slave? Because that's a question that people ask. And there are more difficult questions that he was asked as well. I'd want some things like that, but not only. The cute thing I once learned, think about 19th century, there was a Rav who tried to discourage people from, speaking of Purim, discourage people from making noise during Haman. Why? Because pasnish, it doesn't look good. A goyim, a non-Jew can come and hear, this is how we behave in our synagogues. This is the respect we show the reading of the Megillah. I don't think it worked out for him too well. But I would want, that's a dream. That's something I might do.
That sounds great. And whenever that comes out, we can schedule our next interview.
Sure.
I really appreciate it. Thank you very much for the conversation.
My pleasure. And thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking to Kira Sirota about her new book, Haftorah Unrolled, published in 2018. Happy reading, my friends.